And we're on. Why don't you do a quick check?
Booga, booga, booga.
Yep, that works. We're rolling.
I understand. I'm mentally ramping up. Anyway, so we should get started, Mon Frere.
I understand.
Welcome to Mustard Mayonnaise. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
We discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest. Movies, TV, DVDs.
Pornography.
I always have to add that because it does capture our interest.
You never add that.
Every so often you'll do a dirty joke and I'll be like, dude, sometimes my mom listens to this.
Oh, sorry, my mom listens to. My mom just listens to complain about me yawning. I'll try to refrain from yawning.
You know, when the only time we can record this thing is Monday mornings.
Sunday mornings.
See, that's how tired I am.
I know.
I have no concept of what day it is. let's get right into it. Nothing really going on movie-wise. There's nothing out right now that's compelling.
Well, except for Hot Fuzz.
Well, yeah, and before we started recording, we said if I were to go to a movie today, I would probably see Hot Fuzz.
This is the one by the guys who did Shaun of the Dead.
Just because it looks very funny.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily feel the need to pay $10 or go to the trouble of seeing it in a theater.
Yeah.
I'm kind of interested in Fracture, the Hopkins one. I still haven't really done any investigation. I don't know if it's good or not.
Yeah, I'm sort of interested, but to me it's like classic, wait till DVD.
If my wife wanted to see something, we'd see Love Rain Over Me or Rain Over Me. But
I think your wife would love that. It's a good movie. I think you'd like it too.
But there's nothing. There's not like I gotta see it.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's nothing going on movie wise. We're definitely in a dry spell, I think, until the Spider-Man 3 onslaught.
Jesus. And you know, they've looking at the top movies, that Disturbia, which is apparently just a, you know, B quality, fairly good, but basically
Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, it's just like a little cheesy thriller, but 3 weeks in a row, it's number one.
That tells you how crappy the current.
But you know what's interesting is if you look at it, it hasn't really dropped off. It's been a pretty consistent. It's not like a huge opening. It's kept its numbers, which is pretty rare.
Well, it's just like what else are the teenagers going to see?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the bright teenagers would go see Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, if they can get into it. It's an R movie, though. Apparently it's a very violent movie in a joking way. So
I've never thought of R as really keeping out teenagers.
Well,
I know that there's like,
when I was a kid, but then again, honestly, even when I was a kid, I always went with my dad. Half the time because you know, when I was a certain age, I needed to get to the theater, so I had to have my dad drive me, so I just talked him into going to the movie. And then there was that like year period between when I had a car and I wasn't 17 yet. And even then, I'd still go with my dad. So it's hard for me to imagine. But a lot of them, I've seen them sit there and card people at theaters. Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
I know there's been I've seen signs in the box office, you know, we card for whatever. I've just never seen it.
I've definitely seen it. The weird thing about it is there. Hang on just a second.
Spud, get off of there.
My cat is clawing my screen.
You don't need to yell at the cat. You could have like waved to me. I would have done something.
Sorry.
We don't need to yell into the
but
microphone.
But anyway, the weird thing is, I don't think there's an actual law against it. It's basically the MPAA sets these voluntary standards, and their concern is if they don't do them, that somebody will come in and the government will come in and enforce them. But I don't think there's an actual law that would. At least I'm not mistaken, that would actually send anybody anywhere to do any kind of time if they let in a kid.
I've never thought of it that way, but I think you're right, because the whole point of having an industry ratings board is to prevent laws
the government
from being passed, saying we'll regulate ourselves
exactly.
To avoid you regulating
Which
us.
Is one of the reasons why the ESRB is so concerned about, you know, a lot of these movements with Hillary Clinton and
ESRB is the video games
entertainment
rating
something ratings board. They the part of the reason they're so concerned about movements to clarify and look at it is because they're worried if they're perceived as completely ineffectual that the government will come in and step in and it will ruin the industry. Now you probably heard last week that Jack Valenti died.
That's on my list for later.
Yeah,
but we can talk about it now.
Well, Valenti, of course, he was the guy that he was the first head, or as far as I know, the first head, certainly the major force of the MPAA. He was the former Lyndon Johnson aide who went to head the MPAA, and this was a guy who ushered in the ratings board and the rating system, the X rating, which they didn't trademark, the other ones which they did, and all their stuff. And it's so funny because he was so somewhat hated by critics like Roger Ebert and others so much for how ridiculous the MPAA is and how arbitrary it is and their standards. And I always looked at it like, you know, it may or may not be ridiculous and arbitrary, but it is, simply put, the thing that prevented governmental regulation. And there was a huge push for governmental regulation, especially early in the industry, and they simply prevented that. And I do recognize that the ratings, as they're determined, have made this peculiar brand of comedy, you know, that the hard PG-13 comedy, which is a comedy that absolutely should be an R comedy, but they try to make it PG-13 so teens can get into it. My favorite case being Dude, Where's My Car, which was a dumb movie, which would have been a great movie. Just filmed it like they wrote it, which is an R movie. But beyond all that, I think Pardon?
I mean, if you're discussing that, but you're leaving out the business context.
Well,
No,
I understand. It's a business decision.
Right, but you're not.
The MPAA created a system that basically made it's hard for teens to go see comedies, and they're one of the purveyors of comedies, and so they have to create these things that anybody could get into. So they make a comedy that just pushes up to the line but is not an R. And Dude, Where's My Car is a drug comedy. It's a major drug comedy, at which point they never actually mention drugs in it, and it effectively ruins it. And even though Harold and Kumar was not great, at least it was an R comedy. And I mean, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
But it showed where Dude, Where's My Car could have gone. And it was really, so I kind of hate that for that. But that said, that's just whatever. MPAA has been, I think, the thing that's preserved and helped the industry thrive by keeping out governmental regulation.
Yeah,
Lord knows I do not want George Bush deciding what movies I get to see any more than I would have wanted Bill Clinton to.
I've seen a lot of fond remembrances of Valenti, but the one he made some comments. Is that actually? I guess that's a drinking glass.
It's not a drinking glass. It's sort of a mini pitcher, but all my glasses are in the dishwasher, so I'm drinking out of it. That would be, if I was in Munich, München, that would be how much you would drink if you bought ein glass of beer.
Okay. But there were some comments Valenti made, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago, talking about the potential of downloading movies and theft that were so retarded.
Yeah.
Like, I don't just mean that in a pejorative fashion. I mean actually retarded.
Yeah.
That I lost...
He was pretty out of touch. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, this is ridiculous, and I couldn't get over that. And I of course, I don't have any of those comments in front of me right now.
He had the challenge. He was the spokesperson for an industry that absolutely recognizes that the major threat to that industry is the fact that their product is so easily stolen.
But movies are a lot. It seems like whoever's enforcing that isn't anywhere near as tight-assed as the RIAA.
No, they're not. And part of that was, I think, sheer luck. The RIAA was completely caught off guard early on, and it was and songs were just so cheap to, or not cheap. They were so small, so it was easily transferable movies.
Yeah.
Remember, for the longest time, they'd say, "Oh, nobody's transferring movies because they're enormous." Well, who would say that now? But the thing was, is because they were to learn from that, they were able to learn the lessons from the RIAA and put a damper on trading sites and other stuff before they got off the ground in a way that the RIAA was unable to do. But, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, Valenti, simply, it's his job to be a spokesman to try and stop this. And you'd look at some of their efforts, and they would be embarrassing and goofy, but it's hard to blame them, especially when they recognize the growing influence of China as a market and other stuff, and realizing that the value of their product in China is nothing because it's all pirated instantly. I mean, that's got to be frustrating, but, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, there was a lot of times towards the end. He retired, I think, a couple of years ago. And towards the end, it was pretty clear that he was an older guy, somewhat out of touch with the modern realities and doing his best to keep up. But a smooth guy, smooth character.
So they're going to make a 15-minute short film updating Spinal Tap.
They've made it.
They already shot it?
Yeah, well, it's getting its premiere, like, either today or tomorrow at Tribeca. So,
how awesome is that?
It's friggin' cool. And it's to promote, like, something for global warming. But, you know, something that they one of the greatest things ever happened many, many years ago. When they filmed that movie, it was like this confusing financing. I think it was like Avco Embassy or some outfit that was like making movies in the 80s that's gone bankrupt, and then the people at the bottom got bankrupt. And towards the end, Spinal Tap ended up being bought by some French perfume manufacturer, or they own Spinal Tap among many other things. And part of their deal was they will get all rights to everything Spinal Tap unless, like, every 7 years, Spinal Tap renews their hold on the brand. Which is one of the reasons why you'll see a periodic tour, periodic special, periodic appearance, because they're just renewing their claim on whatever's left of Spinal Tap, and I have a feeling this is part of that.
Well, I'm
so
sure.
So it's great for us, because we get to see Spinal Tap
it's
again.
Actual new content. It's not just Nigel Tufnel in a Volkswagen commercial, or hearing Give Me Some Money in an Amex commercial.
And it's directed by Rob Reiner,
right,
as if he's just updating them on where they've been all these years. Apparently they invented the term global warming, according to this movie.
That's awesome.
I can't wait.
I've been really jonesing to see Spinal Tap again. I need to pop that in.
I haven't seen it in many, many years, and the last time I saw it, I'd seen it like a year before, and it was oddly not funny. I enjoyed watching it, but I was so into the jokes, and it's been like 4 years, so I'm kind of excited now because I think I'll enjoy it again. I hope I'll enjoy it again. I hope it doesn't, you know, fade into the background.
I agree. NBC has finally said what they're doing with the remaining Studio 60 episodes. Once ER's season is over, the six remaining Studio 60 episodes will go up in its time slot.
Wow.
And yet there has been still no official cancellation notice.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder, well, maybe there will be a ratings resurgence. Maybe they're kind of hedging their bets and saying, you know, we're 90% sure this thing is done. But if it does well enough, maybe we'll talk.
On one level, if I'm not mistaken, there's no downside to them. There's no upside to canceling it now and not later. Because
unless there are contracts,
well, that's what I'm
going to
say.
Renewed.
If they have it, almost certainly they have certain cutoff dates for contract announcements, and more than likely they haven't reached those yet, unless we've heard something differently. And if they haven't, I wouldn't blame them for just waiting until the last minute, because you never know. They might put it on there and go, "Wow, god dang, this is actually not doing that bad.
Well,
maybe we should try it."
I'm just happy that they're being rebroadcast.
I am too, so I don't have to buy their stupid special edition DVD just to watch them.
Probably do that anyway.
Well, if there's commentaries, I'll do it. If there's not.
And especially if the commentaries are from the perspective of after they were canceled.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe here's where here's where the focus grouping told us to switch it into a relationship comedy, even though we didn't want to do that. That's what I want to hear. I want to hear that it was the studio's fault, or that they forced this ridiculous change in emphasis. But anyway, that's exciting. Drive, already canceled.
After three shows.
Three episodes in.
Halfway through the third show.
And, you know, and my one complaint was that the characters were one-dimensional. They were in the process of beefing them out. I thought after the third episode, okay.
But it got good reviews. It clearly just nobody saw it. I mean, that's got to be their reason.
Well,
I'll bet you it was expensive, too.
I don't know how expensive. I mean, there's...
But it's competition with a bunch of moving vehicles.
Well, right, but if Nathan Fillion is your biggest name...
That's true, but I think it's one of those shows like... Lost. Don't forget, Lost had no big names. It was, I mean, later they got some bigger ones, but Lost, it was like a huge cast of relative unknowns because the expense of the show was going to be the expense.
I mean, clearly, the major cost with this, you're right, is filming on location and filming. I don't know how much of the car work was done practically or, you know, if it was, you know, jigs on a set.
Yeah.
It's actually, from my perspective, pretty hard to tell. It looked like most of it was filmed actually out there, even though filming with car rigs and filming in environments like that is notoriously difficult
and expensive and hard for an actor to focus and
rough on the crews and the directors Anyway, it's just depressing because I want Nathan Fillion to do well.
Oh, he'll get a job sooner or later.
Anyway, so that was kind of a bummer. But yeah, 3 weeks. Stupid Fox. Can't they let anything get a toehold?
You know, in the old days, any show they put on, if it had even a hint of anything, it would stay on forever because they had nothing else, and now they're just as bad as any other network. I mean, back in the old days, like Married with Children and other stuff, nobody watched them at all, and they just built later as people signed on as affiliates, and nowadays, 3 shows. I mean, that's stunning.
It's just ridiculous.
Wonder how many shows they filmed of that.
Two more that were filmed that they'd burn off at some point, and then that was it. Let's see. Let me cross things off the list here as we go. You emailed me the Ain't It Cool Transformers review.
Oh, Jesus.
I didn't read any of it. I read your comment.
Well, it was, okay, so it was a review, and it was an announcement by Moriarty saying, yep, it's your first official review of Transformers. And then he talks about it saying, now I know people are going to scream plant because it might sound obvious, and then others are going to say, no, it's clearly not because it's too mean to the movie, or it's not mean enough, but here it is. And then you read the review, and it's the most obvious plant in the history of plants. Reading this thing, and I'm thinking, what, Moriarty, are you on drugs? I mean, because it's so clearly a guy going, wow, it rocks. Now, it's not perfect, and as he describes, it's not perfect because in this section, it's not awesome enough, or it could be more awesome, but of course they had to do this little thing here. Even the negatives were obviously positives, and then it would like periodically delve into, you know, teen, you know, spelling, you know, that wacky spelling that they'll do text messaging, but nowhere near enough that just towards the end, it just devolved into a clearly articulate person
just
doing their best. I'm thinking if I was working at a studio, I would just be more obvious than this. I would actually ask a studio employee to say, hey, check this out. If you like it, we're going to vet it before you do it. But write your own thoughts on this and be relatively honest. But if you really like it, do it. Give it to us. And then if we think it, send it. And send it to Moriarty saying, yep, I work for a studio. I actually have seen it. And here's what I think. Because it's going to come across way better than this fake thing here. And they make a big point about it being at a particular theater in Peoria, Arizona. And I'm thinking, where the F are all the other people that should have seen this and been written in? It was so clearly a plant.
Yeah, I do not care about early reviews like that.
Every once in a while I'll read one and get excited because you'll read it and you'll see. And this was obvious.
Every so often, if it's something like, you know, Stardust, which is varying from the source material enough that I'm interested if it's going to be successful. But, like, Transformers, I'm going to see anyway. Just to see the robots transform. That's the hook for me.
Absolutely.
I don't care if the plot sucks. So reading an early review does nothing for me either way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the whole, you know, and I totally understand what you're saying about studio plants. To me, it's like a waste of effort to determine one way or the other. I just can't get worked up
about it. When I look at
it,
I see how for me, I know that Ain't It Cool News has a small but very legitimate impact on the movie industry, especially movies like this. These movies are clearly somewhat dependent on how Ain't It Cool News, this dumb website, reacts to their stuff. So when I look at stuff like this, it does make me mad because I'm going,
in terms of how the studio is handling it, that makes sense.
Now from the other perspective, the same week, I think it was Moriarty too, posted a picture of Heath Ledger as the Joker. And he says, now, I'm not sure what this is, but it looks legit. And he goes on a big limb saying it's legit and everything. And then all these people get all upset over this picture. Some people loving it. Some people saying, hating it. Some people saying, get over yourself. It's legit. It's good because this is what's happening. And it's like he looks like the Crow is what he did. It's like kind of you can see like scars on the side of his thing going back and forth. And then some people debating whether it's real or not. And then you look at these other websites, detailed the smuggest thing you've ever seen, talking about how, yes, fanboys, of course it's real, and here's why, and you need to move on because of course this and that. And then anyway, finally the guy who faked it announced on the website that he faked it. It's like, geez. And honest to God, I've never seen people get more sanctimonious over something so stupid, something so tiny and small as this image. I mean, literally, there was probably 100,000 words spilled between the announcement and then the time the guy finally admitted he had faked it and show how he faked it.
There's another example where I just don't care.
Oh, I just look at this and I'm going, why are you guys spending all of this time? My only interest was just to see, to read people that got all sanctimonious because later proving them wrong that it was fake. But I don't know.
You know what? If these socially inept people can only vent through forums about inconsequential crap like what is Heath Ledger going to look like in the next Batman movie, if venting through forums keeps them from going to school and shooting people, knock yourselves out.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I saw the picture on Dark Horizons as I was flipping through their random stuff, and I was like, okay, whatever. I don't care one way or the other.
Yeah. Speaking of shooting people, did you watch Meet the Press last week?
I never watched the Sunday morning
stuff. I get that because I don't have TV anymore. I get the podcast. It's like the one entertainment I have because it's free. So I watch it. And Tim Russert, he says, so he's talking to the panelist. So it's been widely reported that Cho Chung, whatever his name is, played lots of video games. And what do you think the connection is of this, considering he was clearly an aficionado? And then they have these people go on to explain how video games are awful and everything. Nowhere has anybody indicated this guy's made video games. It, literally, Tim Russert just made it up. And then later, he revisits the issue. And I'm thinking, no wonder people hate video games, because it's like this accepted truism that they're dangerous. Well, and looks to back any of this up. The only fact I know is that since the rise of video games, the incidence of teen violence has dropped precipitously. That's the only thing I know for a fact.
You know it for a fact?
It's a fact. It's a fact. You look at the FBI statistics. Teen violence has dropped off a rock over the last decade, along with the rise of video games. So if you're going to make causal comparisons or correlations, you might as well say teen or video games have clearly contributed to the decline of violence amongst teens.
Of course, there was a Daily Show segment where they show some blowhard on Fox, video game, video game, video game, and then they're interviewing like one of the guy's old dorm mates. Guy's like, yeah, he never played video games.
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't see that. I would like to see it.
Classic Stewart using videotape to contradict a stated fallacy. Yeah. And God, there was another aspect to it, like he listened to violent music or something like that. The guy's like, no, he never listened to that kind of music. You know, he listened to classical, and you know, he read the Bible, and
so especially the Bible thumpers, they love to do this and that. But then when somebody actually is the killer, actually thinks that they were, you know, God was telling them to, then they say that person's disturbed. And it's like, wait a second, is the person like a rational person if they listen to AC/DC, but disturbed if they believe in the Bible? What are you trying to tell us? It makes no sense. Anyway.
In the same vein, so there's this Bill Moyers has a new show on PBS, Bill Moyers Journal.
Yep.
And it sort of debuted with a special about the media's complicity with the run-up to the war in Iraq.
And this one where he interviews Jon Stewart,
no,
part of it? Or it's a different one?
Okay. Same series, different
show.
The first episode, if you will, was this special. It wasn't considered an actual episode.
And it's available as podcast, which is really cool. PBS is finally getting these shows on podcast.
It's in like five or six chapters online on the website. And so I'm like halfway through chapter four. It's a progressive download, and once my QuickTime player gets caught up, suddenly it won't download anymore. So I kind of have to watch it and reload. Yeah. So I'm like halfway through chapter four. It's a great special. It's very, you know, Bill Moyers just cuts through the crap, and he says, you know, here's where, you know, the vice, you know, he's got Tim Russert as a guest. Here's where the vice president was on your show, Meet the Press, and said, you know, and pointed to a report in the New York Times. Well, now that it's out there about the tubes, we can discuss that, you know, these are, you know, nuclear grade aluminum tubes that you'd only use to, when they're down to these specifications, you would only use them for nuclear weapons. And, you know, it was classified material, but since it's been reported in the New York Times,
which they fed to the New York
Times. And Moyers is like, well, yeah, when the administration leaks a report and then goes on to the TV show and points to that report, it's a, you know, it's this self-contained cycle that's just, it self-reinforces. It's ridiculous. And Tim Russert had some ridiculous answer like, well, nobody called me to be on the other side. If somebody would have called.
Yeah, that's a and one. Every once in a while,
And Moyers was like, the 60 Minutes, his next cut was to one of the 60 Minutes reporters, Pelly. Yeah. Scott Pelly, I think that's it. You know, and it says, Scott Pelly did pick up the phone and make some phone calls, and here's what he came across, and it was a good little counter.
Yeah.
Counterpoint.
Every once in a while, you wish journalists would just go, God, you know, I've looked back and I kind of screwed up there. I just screwed up. And every once in a while, reporters do it, but some just feel, they feel like they're this omnipotent presence, so they kind of keep having to defend it, because if they feel they admit to getting something wrong or being part of something, they think it's going to call into question everything. And I'm thinking, no,
it's
not. Well,
it seems like there's this, the class of reporters that covers the administration that's in Washington, D.C., is more concerned with being friendly with the people they cover and, you know, being invited to the same cocktail parties and being, you know, the in crowd and being liked and being cool rather than actually doing their jobs.
Yeah.
So that's part of the issue. So this Bill Moyers,
I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it.
Takes a great and fantastic view of it. Now, the first actual episode was half Jon Stewart, half Josh Marshall.
Yeah.
So the Jon Stewart part, and I watched it online yesterday.
I watched a little bit of the
Actually,
Stewart
I watched
part.
It on TV.
Who's Jon Marshall?
Josh Marshall, Talking Josh Marshall. Points Memo.
Oh, yeah, Talking Points Memo.
So
I love that
the
guy.
Stewart stuff was fantastic. That was the best interview with Jon Stewart I've ever seen. And he's, you know, they've done 60 Minutes clips with him, and they've done other interviews with him.
Yep.
That was the best one. Because they're talking, and it was like, they just recorded it last week.
Yeah.
It was brand new material, because they were talking about John McCain's appearance on The Daily Show.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And how brilliant that was.
Jesus, that was the most combative thing I've ever seen. They just talked over each other, but he would not give in and let McCain. I mean, somebody pointed out, several people said, oh, this was the interview that killed John McCain's presidential thing because of how he came across. I don't think it has wide enough reach, but he came across so bad.
John McCain's busy shooting himself in the foot in numerous other ways.
I know.
But that didn't help. But in terms of Moyers and Stewart talking about, you know, how The Daily Show deals with things and how, you know, they reiterate, you know, we are not a source for news, but, you know, we have this mission to be funny and I don't know. It was.
I love when Stewart, the one clip I did see, was he was trying to explain how awful the Gonzalez testimony was. And he said it reminded him of in The Godfather, or no, in Goodfellas, when when Ray Liotta gets arrested and he's all upset and Robert De Niro meets him outside of the jail and he thinks he's going to kill him. And he goes, no, you did good. You did good. Yeah, you got pinched, but you did it right. You didn't talk. And that's what Gonzo did is he didn't talk, and that's what Bush was saying. You did right.
To veer wholly into politics for a moment, when you look at the whole Gonzalez thing from the perspective of two key things, and that is Gonzalez is taking all the slings and arrows instead of Bush and Rove.
Yep.
And two, from the when you look at it from the perspective of they all view themselves as above the law. That if the president does it, it's not a crime. There's no accountability. It's all unitary executive theory.
Exactly. They literally created this ridiculous theory to support it.
When you look at it from the perspective of that, then Gonzalez's testimony is from the perspective of, I'll come down and talk to you people, but I'm under no obligation to tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the windows because somebody fired up a lawnmower.
Okay. Yeah, they've got that ridiculous baloney theory that Gonzalez basically helped author, and this unitary executive theory or privilege has no legitimacy. It's never been tested in any court, and it's so clearly antithetical to basic democratic principles. Yet that's the way they operate.
Well,
under.
Yeah, and so when you look at it from that, suddenly the Gonzalez doesn't seem like as much of a moron. He's filling his role.
He's obviously not a moron. Did you see, though?
Basically ignoring Congress, and they could give a crap about Congress because they don't think Congress has any function.
He went to the his 25th anniversary of the Harvard Law School reunion.
Oh, did he?
It was just a couple days ago, and people protested him, and they were... I can't remember what it was, but it was fairly amusing. Just people screaming, impeach, resign, and other stuff while he was trying to do stuff. It's kind of tacky to go to some guy's reunion. By the same token, it's a pretty public figure, and it's hard not to. And I don't know if you saw yesterday, like 1,000 people on a beach in San Francisco lined up and spelled out because they knew it'd get a lot of helicopter attention. Just thousands of people lining up. Spelling out the words impeach now! ! That's kind of cool. Made a lot of news.
You know what? I will take that over anytime I see footage of a protest and they're chanting.
Yeah.
I cannot stand protest chanting.
Yeah.
Every time I hear it, I need to turn the channel. Yeah. It's like one of those base of the spine. Fingernails on the chalkboard, and I think, what a horrible way to get your message across, because you've instantly reduced your effectiveness, in my eyes, your potential audience. Hey, hey, ho, ho, blank has got to go. Are you kidding me?
And you instantly look at the folks, and you start going, oh, I know these kinds of people. These are people that would,
even if
I got stuck with them in a conversation in an elevator, I'd be like hitting the next floor button.
Even if I completely agree with what they're saying. That protest chanting so completely turns me off that their effectiveness is negated anyway.
I agree.
I like how I tied that back into the media.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, great Moyers section, which you can look up online with Jon Stewart.
And I believe download from iTunes, although the Stewart one isn't on yet. Maybe it is. I don't know. I'll have to look.
And the second half is with Josh Marshall. I think I had surfed that site randomly before, but then you forwarded to me and said, hey, have you seen this guy?
Yeah.
He does his own coverage. And I remember, like, the first time you emailed me about it, and this is talkingpointsmemo.com, you said, you know what? This guy said on his website, I would like to go cover the primaries in New Hampshire, but I can't afford it. If my readers donate money, I will go cover the primaries in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And it worked.
And his whole point is that. I mean, the original founding thought of it was that the Republicans brilliantly have created this strategy of communication where they, on a daily basis, they have their talking points. So all of a sudden, on the news, you'll hear Karl Rove say something, then all of a sudden you'll hear Michael Savage, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, everybody else using the same language, the same terminology. They're creating these talking points, and what he does is kind of reverse engineer those talking points, determine what they are, and point out how baloney that was. That was his original thoughts, and now it's just sort of a generalized blog.
God, and the most recent example of which was the political presentations by the Karl Rove deputy at the various governmental agencies talking about, here's the endangered Republicans for the 2006 elections. Here's basically what you can do to help Republicans. And then that moron at the GSA, how can we help our candidates? A clear violation of the Hatch Act, which is supposed to separate, the actual party politics from government employees doing their job.
Exactly.
And as reporters were calling around asking the agencies about these presentations, the article says, mid-afternoon, the talking points had been distributed, and everyone was referring to them with the same phrase. These were informational briefings presented to the employees about the political landscape. And you're just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it's awful.
And it's so blatant. So you're right. And this is... he's a liberal.
Yep.
I think he would agree with that characterization. He's not,
he's not uber liberal though. He's more, more just a guy who loves politics and resents the way it operates.
It seems like there's a key difference between the conservative blogs and the liberal blogs where most, and I won't say all, most of the conservative blogs have no problem repeating the party line, repeating the talking points, and just being part of this echo chamber.
Yeah.
Whereas the liberal blogs, or at least I like to think so, don't repeat the liberal party line. They just attack the hypocrisy wherever.
Yeah.
I've seen the liberal blogs go after that idiot Congressman Johnson or Jackson in Louisiana that
that hid the cash in the freezer.
$50,000.
They've lambasted him. They've said this guy should not be on the whatever committees he's on.
Oh, absolutely.
So I view the liberal bloggers as far less hypocritical than the conservative bloggers.
Oh, absolutely.
And anyway, Josh Marshall in Talking Points Memo, to my mind, is the best of the bunch.
Yep.
The most even-handedly written, the most well-researched, and he's expanding his empire, hiring researchers and hiring actual reporters and actually doing this incredible journalism. Actual
wow.
journalism.
I know, actual journalism in a totally new environment. Yeah, it's
anyway,
pretty exciting.
Let's get away from politics for a while. I just saw this morning, via an Ain't It Cool link, mm-hmm. that Passions, this soap opera, is moving from NBC to DirecTV only.
Wow.
So it's if you want to see Passions, your only avenue to see it is to subscribe to DirecTV.
Hmm.
And, you know, they're pointing out, how would you feel if Battlestar Galactica, if Caprica, if Firefly, if, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars or whatever was...
Caprica? What the hell is that?
That's the proposed spinoff to Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, okay.
That's currently on hold. What if those shows were only available via one distribution channel?
Hmm.
And, you know, we've kind of touched on this in terms of Sunday Ticket only being available through DirecTV, which is all NFL games as a package. And that's a horrible way to go.
Well, first off,
that would really, really piss me off.
It's important to note that there's one way to look at it is availability. There is tons of shows that are exclusively only available on certain setups and systems.
Well, there's a difference between, like, HBO programming, because you can get HBO through any number of distribution
channels.
Yeah, but you
can. I'm not talking about HBO. I'm talking about specific ones. Comcast, for instance, has a few channels which they fund and do not let on Time Warner Cable or other outlets.
Is it original content?
Some of it is original content. Some of the on DirecTV, there's many channels there that for whatever reason you can only get on DirecTV. Some of them are like these kind of almost public access kind of things. It's kind of crazy. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that I don't have a your I think the concern here is, if you had heard that DirecTV was creating their own show and putting it on their little soap opera channel on their daily, you probably wouldn't have a problem with it. The problem is it started on a network TV and is moving.
That's part
there.
Of the problem.
And the thing is, if you saw Passions, you'd realize, it, not that I've seen a lot of it, but it is the most low rent of all
I'm
of the shows.
I'm surprised you've seen any of it.
Oh, every once I would used to joke our mutual friend, Holly, talking about her stories. So every once I'll flip across them and then go, oh my God, is this her story? And then realize, no, or she'll explain how Passions is. Well, I won't go into the terms, but it's pretty damning.
I'd be curious to hear that after we stop recording, because Holly has a way with words,
she does.
Which is fantastic.
But Passions is just as low rent. Is Passions the one with the... with the witches and stuff? I can't remember, but anyway,
boy, could I not tell you?
It's really low rent. So it's just, you know, this is just a show that probably gets 200,000 viewers.
My problem with distributors use their muscle to deny other distributors content.
Yeah.
I have no, you know, if somebody wants to create content, knock yourself out. I think that's part of the whole beauty of the web and the net and iTunes and self-distribution. But I don't think it's, you know, if Comcast wants to make its own content and then distribute it, you know, I think there should be regulation which says they must offer it to others and at a not exorbitant price. I have to think that through. Maybe there's a fallacy in my logic.
I don't necessarily disagree. My only concern is at some point they have to go, well, what makes us different? Is there a way we can differentiate ourselves? And for instance, DirecTV...
Well, God knows Comcast isn't going to do pricing or customer service to differentiate themselves.
So DirecTV is saying, listen, exceptions, anybody in America, 99% of Americans can get DirecTV. No, I mean, in the 48 states. 99...
It's got to be lower than that. There's substantial geographical...
Well, if you're behind a mountain, but there's no...
Well, not even a mountain. My friend Dan lives near Lake Sammamish.
Okay.
I wouldn't call that a mountain, but he's down the hill from from whatever.
If you were anywhere south of Ashland, Oregon, that's not a problem because it's almost straight up into the sky.
Okay.
95%.
I don't accept that number, but I
that's just an internal gut check. I would be really curious to know what the actual number, you know, 300 million Americans, how, what is the percentage of actual American households on a house-by-house basis that cannot get a good satellite
95%.
Signal?
The overwhelming vast majority of people can get it.
I still disagree with that, but that's fine. Let's move on.
Okay. If I bring it up again, are you going to disagree again?
I just want to go on record that I think your number is high.
Okay, well, I mean, I just know the angle of these things. I, for instance, can't get it at my house unless I cut down a tree. But the fact is, I can get it. So anyway, you can, the vast majority, if vast means 19 out of 20 or 18 out of 20 Americans can get it, pretty much can get it. Cable, higher density, but not much different. So there's a, so it's not like you're talking about 5% versus 95%. So DirecTV is...
That's not my issue.
Well, but I'm saying, so DirecTV is saying, okay, so we have a similar product. There's differences, but a similar product with similar services. We want to differentiate. Well, one of the most classic ways to differentiate, if most of your product is beholden to these other suppliers, you're going, we're just beholden to Showtime Networks, Paramount Television, Time Warner with HBO and stuff. What can we do that's different? And they think, well, let's develop our own stuff to draw people to this thing. And originally, that's what differentiated cable TV and regular TV. The first original regular TV was not to provide new channels. It was to provide a good signal to existing channels. And then they started saying, well, let's develop home box office. Let's develop other kinds of channels and stuff. And I would argue DirecTV is probably doing the same thing, going, God, what difference does it make? Well, let's make it a difference. Let's give us something.
Here's my problem. I mean, and I totally understand the case for that, the business case for that, the creative case for that. My problem as a consumer is, if you know, if Firefly is picked up by DirecTV and Battlestar Galactica is picked up by Dish and they're exclusive to those, am I supposed to then have two satellite dishes on my roof and then a Comcast is exclusive to...
Well, if you're a pure market, if you're a pure lover of the pure market, which of course we're not, we've got other issues, but they would say, yeah, well, that's the problem of the marketplace. It will figure it out.
You know what? Then I don't pay for any of them because that is detestable behavior.
Exactly, it is. But then the makers of those products have to go, do we want to piss off our fans? Where is our fan going? And on, as a natural evolution, one service will probably be more of the sci-fi service than somebody else, or they'll say, we can't do this. We need to give alternate modes of distribution, be it iTunes, be it Xbox Live, or something. They're gonna come up with that, but the market, if you were to say it that way, would say, you know, no, that's the whole point, is to make something better. I mean, it killed me when I had Comcast. I always wanted to check out this HDNet channels, these ones that Mark Cuban put together with the Dan Rather reports. Do I get HDNet? No. Why? Because Mark Cuban is in a pissing match with Comcast and doesn't want to have him on there. So HDNet is on basically certain cable systems and the network. Well, am I sitting here going, are they, Comcast is denying me a legal right to see HDNet? No. Because if I really wanted HDNet, I could get DirecTV, I could get, you know, I could get Dish Network if I really wanted it. I mean, that would be my argument. I'm just saying, to a certain extent, it's amazing. It's interesting how we just determine that if we can't get it all in one package, that we're somehow being denied something. And in this marketplace,
you're right. Yeah.
There's just tons of ways to get stuff nowadays.
Yeah, it's complicated.
I know.
All right. Let's swing into tech, and then I had we'll see how much time left. That I have an idea. I saw a blurb this morning. A rumor about the next generation iPod will be released right before the iPhone.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's a fresh rumor, right? That was an older rumor as well. Talking about, I got this from Think Secret, and they said there would be a flash version, a hard drive version, and then a hybrid version, which would use the flash, the flash NAND.
That would be good to make
serve
it for battery
as the buffer
life.
Chip.
It'd also be good for battery life, you'd think, because the 90% of the problem with these video things is the constantly running hard drive. I mean, that's that and of course the light, the screen. But
I would imagine its ability to also distract Richard while he's driving is another problem with it.
Well, it doesn't distract me. I focus on the iPod.
That's fantastic. I am when I hear that you've died because of that, I'm going to come down here, liberate your DVDs.
I don't watch the iPod, but I do have it mounted there so I can listen to podcasts. And that's what's convenient about video podcasts is you can also just select the audio option so you can listen to them, and it just plays the audio version, so there won't be that distracting video.
So it'll be interesting to see if that does happen. You know, and it almost would have to because, you know, the sales of the high-end iPods would immediately drop. Everyone would just get an iPhone, you know, with some flexibility in there, and that the iPhone's capacity is severely limited.
That's crazy. And I've been wondering about that because the big thing I've been wondering about is battery life for those iPhones.
I saw another blurb this morning that the battery life is actually fine despite the spate of rumors that went around in the last month that the talk time was like 20 minutes.
And I know that's part of the main reason why initially they probably didn't have a hard drive, but it just struck me as like, wow. How are they going to deal with this? Because people expect to have their phone
left on for a
day and a half.
No matter what, it's going to be a significant issue because in addition to that, they want it to do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And
why has Apple always been so resistant to removal of batteries? What's up with that?
That's a good question, and I don't know.
Because people have complained. And finally, they had an agreement early on. Well, if your battery does die, we'll replace it for $50 or something. But I've always wondered why, especially with cell phones. They're going into an industry where I can't think of a single cell phone I've ever seen that does not have a replaceable battery. Yet they're going into this with the only one that doesn't have a replaceable battery. It just seems weird. Especially given that a replaceable battery is a good help for people that don't have access to chargers but want to have that phone on. You just keep an extra battery.
We will see. We will see. It's
shouldn't it be out by now? Didn't they say April?
What, the iPhone?
Yeah.
No, June.
Oh, June, April. Maybe.
A lot of people were targeting June 11th.
Oh, no, you're right. I forgot. I had it in my head April.
We're at the end of April. It's almost May, so it's about a month and a half. Well, potentially 2 months away.
Or in Apple TV terms, it's about 5 months away.
I
don't think this will be late at all.
Think it will be pushed past.
Engineers onto the project.
It's interesting listening to Twim and Twit discussing that aspect, and like either it makes it look like Apple doesn't have engineers that they couldn't afford to reallocate, that they didn't know what they were doing and weren't allocating resources appropriately to begin with, or that there's some other bizarro reason which they don't want to disclose.
It does sound weird. You got to wonder how much is involved. Are they talking about interface issues?
And Alex Lindsay, who you know, I've come to worship as a god.
Yep.
The guy is really bright. I think his point is that they're focusing a lot on the interfacing aspects of how it's going to integrate with the Mac, how the iPhone's going to integrate, and that it
Mac or PC or both.
Probably, well, his...
Because the vast majority of people getting this are going to have a PC.
Well, but if they see how well it plays with the Mac, maybe that's another driver of Mac sales.
Yeah.
But because he has written programs for the Mac, and he knows how much work it takes to, you know, for the program to interact with the laptop. And
well, if that's what they're doing I say UI good for them, because that's one hallmark of what they do. You know, they'll make software, but you just don't really have many complaints about when it's there. It just seems to work really incredibly well and fun and easy to use. And if that's what they're allocating their energy towards, good for them, because so many engineering or software companies, that's like the last thing on their mind. They think, well, we'll deal with it on version 3. Let's just get it out there and work it. Let's not have any human engineers look at it in terms of interface. And Apple seems to have the other route, and I say good for them. Now, if they would just make a version of iTunes that doesn't completely take over my entire processing power of my computer, I'd be happy. I sometimes think they do that with the Windows machines as a subtle way to encourage people to get Macs, because I go to my dad's computer and iTunes does not take over his computer, and my computer, all of a sudden, everything else is down to a slow crawl while it works in the background, and all it's doing invariably is just downloading files, yet it's taking like 97% of the processing power.
Nice. Where are we at on time there, Skippy?
We're at 50 minutes.
Okay. I thought it'd be interesting to, what podcast do you subscribe to?
Oh, to tons of them. So I described to about 40 of them.
What are the ones you actually listen to? Do you listen to all
40?
Well,
lately, yeah.
I need to explain for a second. Richard's the type of person that can do about four things at once.
Yeah.
He'll be listening to a movie commentary while he's, you know, writing an article, laying out the article
and watching TV
and
watching
movie. and listening to Howard Stern in the background.
Well, as somebody pointed out that you know they did this survey of people that are really self-described really effective multitaskers. In fact, they're horrible at multitasking. They just do a lot of things at once and try to get them all in. Okay, so the ones I listen to regularly are Twit. Again, I used to not listen as much. This Week in Tech, TWIM.
This Week in Media.
Cranky Geeks. I also listen to a whole spate of NPR ones, such as Diane Rehm Show, such as Fresh Air. And all of these I will listen to at least 3 times a week. Fresh Air, Leonard Lopate Show, WAMU's Here and Now.
What's that?
Whatever the JMU is, but it's yet another politics.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the NPR shows that gets national.
I never heard of that station before. I thought you were talking about Washington Mutual.
No, WAMU.
Home financing? What?
On the Point with Tom Ashbrook, I listen to quite often. These are all, honestly, a lot of these shows, I don't even know what they are. I just click on, I see the subject matter, and it's basically a national NPR show that's done from a local station. I might listen to The Treatment once a week. I also download NBC Nightly News and CBS Nightly News, and I watch those 3 times a week. I watch Face the Nation and Meet the Press every week, and I also watch Geek Brief TV sometimes, although it's mostly annoying these days. And that's all I can think of. But I do a lot. I probably listen to 40 hours of podcasts a week.
I do Twit as well, and you turned me on to that. Mm-hmm. It kind of went through a lame spell, and it's getting a little better.
Yeah, I stopped listening for a good 6 months, and then I started listening.
You know, it's just that there were. And I think it's because the commentators got busy.
Yeah.
And so the commentators Leo was able to get weren't quite as good.
And they had a couple where it was clear they self-analyzed and thought, wow, we just went nuts. There was a one particular show where they had Kevin Mitnick on.
What you're going to see. Yeah, Kevin Mitnick and Woz.
And Wozniak. And it was so
a horrible show.
Annoying and boring as they and Wozniak is beloved. We love the guy. But he went on some tangent that was so not funny, so annoying.
And part of it's because Leo himself can go off on these tangents and kind of his radio personality kind of comes through where he's a little more fawning and accepting than he should be.
Oh, speaking of him being fawning and accepting, I do listen to Security Now every week and have to listen through his periodic fawning over Steve Gibson, his co-host, and his periodic fawning over the latest Tech Jansen adventure sci-fi book that Steve Gibson has recommended to him, as I just roll my eyes and trying to hit fast forward on my podcast for 30 seconds. Nope, still talking about it. Nope, still talking about it. Ah, good. They're back to the subject I want to listen to.
So, okay, Twit, and then This Week in Media, which I avoided for a long time because I thought when they said media, it was going to be like kind of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And a meta-analysis of what's going on in the media. Yep. It's like, you know what? I do that myself.
Yeah.
But it's actually, I think it's one of my two favorite podcasts. And it's really intelligent, consistent commentators are on every week discussing, you know, what's going on from a more of a tech perspective in the media.
A lot of digital gear, a lot of video gear, stuff like that.
And how, like, the red camera is going to affect things.
Did you hear Lindsay on Twit last week? And
I'm actually in the middle of... Well, wait a minute. Maybe I finished that show. I think I finished
Because they're talking about the red camera, and it was so funny.
Oh, with Dvorak.
Because they kept hammering him going, sounds like a bunch of baloney and hot air to me. And Lindsay, who is normally an extremely, you know, a good person for ferreting out baloney, he's clearly a huge believer in the red camera, which so far... It's kind of vaporware until it totally comes out. But I agree with Lindsay on this totally. I'm totally buying into it. But it was so funny. He was so defensive. He was like, well, I believe, you know, it's so funny about that.
Well, you're making him sound meeker than he was.
No, it wasn't meeker. It was just kind of funny how he clearly had not been in a position before. People were kind of not interested in the product and sort of attacking it somewhat as vaporware.
You know, he said, you know what? I totally get that it was vape. I totally get your opinion that it's vaporware and that I held that opinion as well. But now I have seen enough actual material shot by prototype cameras.
Yeah.
You know, talk to enough real people that you trust that have seen this thing and worked with this thing and say, you know what, this is the real deal. Understandably, they haven't produced them in production quantities yet. They're still at the prototyping stage. But enough people that he trusts in the industry that have seen this thing, he's willing to go out and say, you know what, this is the real deal.
You know,
but yeah, you're right. It was great listening to him go back and forth to Dvorak, who was more of a off-the-cuff dismisser of this thing.
It's funny. If I would be totally a type, if I wasn't making like 50 grand a year as a whatever I do, and I was like one of those engineer in Redmond making 250 grand a year kind of things, guaranteed, absolutely, I would have had my money down, and I'd be counting the minutes to get it, and I'd have a little production room to accommodate it, and I literally would have no particular purpose for the camera, but I would be so excited for the thing.
So,
I mean, I'd have a little room built for it.
Richard is not lying.
And I can guarantee you a big, even though they got Peter Jackson playing with everything else, I think a big audience for this, because of the price point, is relatively well-off geeks that want to have the best there is. And the best there is no longer $250,000. The best there is $15,000. I mean, I would be all over that thing.
So I also listen to Lindsay's other Mac Break Weekly podcast. That's a pretty good podcast.
Yeah, I haven't listened to that much lately, but I did like it.
They're going to be, I think they're going to launch a new Mac Tech Weekly,
yep.
Which is... You know, I'll listen to it, but then I'll get depressed because I will realize how little I actually do with my PowerBook.
Yeah.
And I'll realize I'm using how little capacity I'm using. And if I would just apply myself in my free time, I could be doing so many more cooler things. So that'll be depressing, but interesting. And really, the guests they get for those two shows are great. And right. A lot of them are shared guests, but it ends up being a quality show. So I'll listen to The Business. KCRW is The Business every week. I think that's a really insightful view into the business of Hollywood and gives you a lot of good, you know, it's sort of an interesting door into behind the scenes stuff, as opposed to more of a fluffy Entertainment Weekly.
Because it's from LA, so it's pretty clearly mostly, it was developed as a show basically with insiders, with an audience of a lot of people that know the industry, so they don't feel they have to explain everything and talk about anything else.
And the guest, Claude Brodesser Ackner, who used to be just Brodesser, so you think, okay.
Did he get married, and is it some newfound thing? Or
right.
Yeah, Claude Brodesser.
He's a good host. He does a great job of talking with all different types of people. He did an interview with Stan Winston.
I liked that one.
If you know anything about special effects, you know the name Stan Winston.
The show's called The Winston Effect, and he talked a lot about that. And it was really exciting because he was trying to get Winston to talk about how, to a certain extent, talk about how, well, his era is kind of ending, and Winston's going, no, I'm as vital as I've ever been. And sure, things have changed, but and it was really cool to see it because Winston is one of my all-time heroes, and it was
actually
cool to hear him.
I saw him at when I was at the San Diego Comic-Con in 2001. He was there because his company had done work on the movie The Time Machine, which instantly free. I never saw the movie.
Yeah.
I guess it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I never saw
it. But they had some of the full-size set pieces up at a booth at San Diego, and he was there talking, and he was surrounded by, wasn't a huge crowd, maybe 15 or 20 people, but people who knew who Stan Winston was.
Man,
and it was cool.
When I was like 13, my entire existence was I wanted to be a makeup artist. I was 12 and 13.
See, I just wanted to do special effects. I
wanted
makeup.
To be,
I was more like
well,
ships
when I'm
and
talking
models.
About, when I was talking about makeup, I'm talking about like The Howling. And
I know what you mean. Like
exactly.
Creature
effects. Rob Bottin, Rick Baker. And then, although I wasn't aware of Winston at the time, was Stan Winston. I became aware of Stan Winston when I was like 16 and when Terminator came out. And he did the first, stop motion thing for Terminator. And it was so incredible, even though it was clear, and he also did RoboCop, and the guy was just, and every time I see an interview, he seems like the kind of guy, God, I'd love to go to a restaurant and talk the guy's ear off, you know, listen to him for 2 hours. I mean, he just seems like a great, generous guy, you know, seemed cool.
So, listen to The Business. I download the treatment. I listen to probably half to 75% of them. If
I figure out who the person is.
Right. If the guest is compelling, then I'll listen, or if I know who they are or whatever.
And I really like Elvis Mitchell, but sometimes if it's like a half-assed guest, he's just as fawning to that guest somebody else, and I'll just go, you know, I don't actually want to listen to him be fawning to, you know, Paul Anderson not the one we like, the hack director instead. And I don't want to hear him, you know, delve into details about some guy who clearly isn't a good filmmaker. It's also somewhat a little frustrating to me. I actually have kind of a philosophical objection to people that are movie reviewers who also interview people, because it, to me, it calls into question. I always thought Elvis Mitchell was a good movie critic, but it calls into question that he has these relationships right. with people. I always, that troubles me a little bit.
I download Dignation. I haven't listened to it in probably 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, there are times when they're on and they're funny, they are hysterical.
Yep.
But there are times when you just, it just hasn't been important enough to work into my
same
routine.
With me, but I did down, I've listened to a couple in the last couple months.
Marketplace.
Oh, Left, Right, and Center. I download that.
Okay.
Don't do Marketplace.
I listen to Marketplace. I think that's a really well done show.
Yeah.
On the Media.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Listen to that every week.
Which is another fairly well-done show. Science Friday.
Yep, listen to that. Talk of the Nation I download, too.
I don't do Talk of the Nation. I don't do This American Life. I don't do pretty much any of the other ones you mentioned.
Yep.
I've got...
I know one I listen to. I know you don't listen to. Distorted View Daily.
That's correct.
Love that show. That guy is... awful, and he's sick, but it's really fun, and it's interesting. It's this guy just clearly living in Ashtabula, Ohio, that's putting on this fairly funny show and trying to make a living at it. So he's constantly asking people to sign up for his sideshow, $5 a month, and all this other stuff. But it's legitimately funny. I listen to him, I go, his comedy is in many times as funny as anything I've heard on Mr. Show, anything I've heard on the Conan O'Brien show. I'm sort of surprised the guy hasn't been hired somewhere else doing something else, because he's just this guy doing this show that's clever, funny, pretty high production values considering he's doing it all on his little Mac. So
yeah, I don't listen to anything that's really independent, like, you know, the Tiki Bar TV, which we've talked about in the past.
That stuff is so painful.
Or Ask a Ninja, or any of the Rocket Boom.
I don't even get any of that stuff. It just, although I do watch Geek Brief TV every once in a while, but most of it just seems. It seems like they're trying to create something so they can figure out how to make money with it later rather than anything organic. It just seems sort of random.
And I, you know, a couple weeks ago, I tried subscribing to some F1 podcasts.
What's F1?
Formula One, right?
Oh, Formula One, okay.
And I subscribed to one. I started listening to it while I was doing housework or something. And I got about 60 seconds in. I thought, these people have no clue what they're doing. I can't remember which one it was, but it started out with horrible audio of some guy. I have no idea who the guy is. Doing his race predictions for the race that week. I think Massa will come in first, and Raikkonen will come in second, and Hamilton will come in third. I was like, I have no idea who you are. I don't. You're not offering any insights as to why this is. I don't care. I mean, I can call up my buddy and ask, well, who do you think, and get just as much charge out of it.
Yeah.
And then the second thing was essentially another guy giving his predictions with horrible audio.
Mm.
And I thought, this is not how you do a podcast.
No.
Anyway, so...
we do it how you do it, sitting in a living room on Saturday, Sunday morning.
Yeah, except for the cats.
So can I talk about my...
Yeah, I think that's about all I subscribe to. Every so often I'll go through and see what else. I'm always hesitant about... I don't want to oversubscribe, because then I start feeling like, oh my God, I'm falling behind.
See, I don't mind oversubscribing, because I'll always get rid of. My big problem is I got this damn laptop with a 30 gigabyte hard drive, and I have the full Adobe Creative Suite because I'm a nerd.
30 gigs, that's it?
That's all this thing came with, piece of crap. Well, and I've got the...
even I upgraded mine.
Well,
the original crashed, I had no choice.
I could upgrade the hard disk, but I'm basically clearly next year going to get a new laptop. So and it was hard to get one this year because I have this incredible screen on this thing. So anyway, just with all that said, I have the full Adobe Creative Suite, which takes like 20 gigabytes or 15, 18 gigabytes. So I'm left with this really constantly having to juggle my podcast, and I can't let them get too big. Even though my iPod is 30 gig, I really only have about 7 gigs to play with. And some of these, especially video podcasts, they take 120 megabytes each time. So I'm constantly juggling that. Otherwise, I would just let it fill up and I'd check them out later. Sometimes, like Distorted View, I sat down and downloaded a month and a half's worth and then listened to them all at once. So I kind of like that. So
what was the other thing you
wanted to talk about? Oh, I was going to talk about Xbox. So I've been playing a little bit Xbox. I've been unbelievably busy this week, and that's why I've been doing it, take my mind off it. So I finished driving every single road.
You got that achievement?
Oh, yeah. I'm up to, I have like 750 points on
congratulations. On thank you. 50 point. Was it 50 or 40?
That was 50.
50 points for Richard driving every single road on Oahu.
Yeah, I think it was 50. Maybe it was 40. And then I finished off some other achievements and other stuff, and now I will never touch that game again. Although there's a bunch of multiplayer stuff. I could probably get the 1,000 point. Actually, I could probably get about 920, because there's other ones that just are I'm never going to do. But I hate multiplayer, so screw it. And then I started playing Crackdown again, so now I'm up to... So I finished off a bunch of stuff there, and now it's just, do I want to keep playing it? I've got, like, one more mission to finish that, and I've got the Master Agent. I've got, like, 400 and 450 or 400 points or something, and I'm thinking, I don't know, I'm not enjoying it that much. But I still kind of want to finish those missions, so I'll probably finish the missions and turn it off, and then I will not play any... Actually, I might play Saints Row, because I never really started that.
They just announced Saints Row is going platinum, which means it's now $30 instead of $60.
Yeah, meaning and, it didn't do anywhere near as well as they hoped it would.
No, they just... I'd be curious to look at their charts and their systems for saying, okay, the sale, once the sales reach a certain point, we reprice it at platinum and we get another bump.
Yeah.
And I'd be really interested to see where that point is and how they configure it for each game. And they say, because clearly... You know, Halo 2, I don't think ever went platinum status because people kept buying it at $50 or whatever for the original Xbox.
I think with Saints Row, to a certain extent, they probably see the writing on the wall. Ones that are in the somewhat similar genre.
Or also looking at GTA 4 coming out in the fall.
Crackdown and GTA 4 and also Halo are three games that all would, if you saw them on the same table, you go, well, maybe I'll get it's cheaper.
Well, the other one is Lego Star Wars 2.
When's that coming out? I thought that
it's
already
also,
came
it's
out.
Well, going platinum.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I was like, you know what? I downloaded the demo.
I've heard it was really good.
It was. Everyone who's played it loved it.
Yeah.
For $30? Sure, why not?
Yeah, I'd probably get it for
$30. As soon as I see it for $30, I will get it.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Unless you go, like, online to Amazon, you go to GameStop to buy a used game, and their $60 games are $55. That's how much you get a savings. Now, they buy them from people for, like, $20 and literally add, like, a $30 markup or whatever ridiculous thing. But, you know, so marking them down that way is a really good way to get them anyway.
So
one last thing is we should talk about Roger Ebert. Did you see that picture I sent of poor Ebert?
Yeah, I don't have anything to add.
He didn't look great, but it was such an inspiring story to see. They were showing a picture of Roger Ebert as he's preparing to go to the hospital or going to his Overlook Film Festival, and he's getting through all the surgeries, and at first I didn't even recognize him because his lower jaw has been kind of worked on other stuff. But he was basically saying, yeah, I don't look real great to look at, but, you know, I never looked that great to look at, so I don't really care about that.
Well, I think it's fantastic that he hasn't let the trouble with his jaw area really keep him from doing what he loves and doing it at a high level.
And it was really inspiring and exciting. I mean, he is my, I'd say Pauline Kael is my favorite reviewer of all time, but he's certainly my second favorite movie critic of all time. And as long as I've been reading movie criticism, it's been watching or reading Roger Ebert, and it was just really inspiring. And I certainly hope he gets his voice back. And even if he doesn't, I hope he continues writing because I really enjoy him and I hope he has a long life. And it was a little shocking to see the picture, but after I got over that, it was very inspiring to see that. Mm-hmm. And also read the outpouring of other people who also clearly have been inspired by him as well. It was really cool, and I hopefully he will continue to get better. So
that's all I got.
I don't got anything either.
I got to go home and mow the lawn. Really exciting.
I guess I should too, but I need to buy another blade on mine. I've been waiting, and as you can see, it's turning into a jungle
indeed.
I watch my neighbor mow his lawn.
So I am Matt.
I am Richard.
And if you wish to contact us, you guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com is the preferred method and just about the only method. And that's it. Thanks for watching.